Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Shireen Al-Adeimi, a graduate school student originally from Yemen, who discusses the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, which the ongoing war there has triggered, and U.S. complicity with Saudi Arabia in the carnage. Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive, who assesses the career of pharmaceutical CEO Alex Azar, President Trump's nominee to become the next Secretary of Health and Human Services. And Ariel Sakwe-Deranger, of the Canadian Indigenous Tar Sands Campaign, who talks about the devastating environmental, health, and climate impacts of tar sands oil extraction, where she lives in Alberta, Canada. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After Apple CEO Tim Cook was called before the U.S. Senate to explain the company's use of overseas tax havens to shelter corporate profits, Apple searched for a new tax haven when Ireland raised its corporate tax rate. 2 years ago, Apple moved its overseas subsidiaries to the English Channel island of Jersey, which does not tax corporate profits. Apple hid over $250 billion in Jersey, a crown dependency of Great Britain, which makes its own laws and isn't subject to most EU regulations. According to the Guardian newspaper, from 2014 to 2016, Apple made $122 billion in overseas profits while paying an effective tax rate of just 5.4%. The new disclosure comes from 13 million documents uncovered in the so-called Paradise Papers, which revealed how many major corporations and wealthy families used tax havens to hide profits. The documents leaked from Appleby, a Bermuda-based law firm that provides services to major corporations and the super rich, comes as congressional Republicans are moving to pass tax reform legislation which would cut the U.S. corporate tax rate from 35 to 20%. A provision in the GOP tax bill would initiate a tax holiday allowing multinational corporations to bring billions in corporate profits back to the U.S. at a sharply reduced tax rate, a proposal that critics charge encourages companies to ramp up their tax avoidance strategies in expectations of more tax holidays to come. According to the Christian Science Monitor, tens of thousands of children who were indoctrinated in ISIS schools and traumatized by watching ISIS propaganda videos in Iraq and Syria now suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, aggression, anxiety, and depression. In recent weeks, a multinational coalition of military forces have succeeded in driving ISIS out of their former strongholds in both Iraq and Syria. Therapists now working with these traumatized children say these young people have lost all hope in humanity and may be a generational time bomb of future Islamic extremists. Unfortunately, there's a severe shortage of mental health workers in the region who can provide counseling to these young ISIS recruits. According to Human Rights Watch, many former ISIS child soldiers are now held in Iraqi prisons and face harsh prison sentences. However, under growing international pressure, women and children have been allowed to leave internal refugee camps to return to villages now under the control of the Iraqi government. Still, children suspected of being loyal to ISIS continue to be held in so-called ISIS family camps. As President Trump traveled to China and Vietnam, his administration announced a new crackdown on Cuba, which halts trade deals involving Cuba's military and restricts American tourists visiting the island to group tours. The Trump administration's new rules on Cuba roll back many of President Obama's initiatives to normalize U.S.-Cuban relations. U.S. citizens and companies are now barred from dealing with dozens of Cuban businesses, including hotels, marinas, tourist agencies, and two state-owned rum distillers. In total, Americans will be barred from doing business with 180 enterprises tied to the Cuban military, intelligence, and security services. U.S. companies will be barred from investing in a new economic development zone in Mariel that Cuba envisions as crucial to its commercial future. Critics like James Williams of the group Engage Cuba condemned the restrictions, noting, quote, "The great irony in announcing these regulations on Cuba while President Trump is in communist China is dumbfounding." The White House stated that the new restrictions are not related to recent reports that U.S. diplomatic personnel in Havana have suffered serious illnesses from an alleged sonic attack from an unknown source. While Washington has not accused the Cuban government of being behind the attacks, it says the Cuban government is responsible for not protecting American diplomats while on Cuban soil and has reduced the U.S. embassy staff in Havana by 60%. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The war in Yemen between Shia Houthi rebels and forces loyal to Yemen's president, Abdu Rabu Mansur Hadi, began in 2014 after rebels seized control of the capital city of Sana'a. Saudi Arabia and allied Gulf nations launched a brutal bombing campaign targeting the Houthis in March 2015. Human rights groups have condemned the nonstop Saudi airstrikes for repeatedly targeting civilians and civil infrastructure, such as schools, hospitals, and markets. It's estimated that more than 10,000 people have been killed in the conflict since 2014. However, a larger humanitarian crisis has developed due to a prolonged air and sea blockade, preventing food and medicine from entering the country. As many as 7 million people in Yemen already face famine-like conditions and rely completely on food aid to survive. An outbreak of cholera caused by the destruction of water and sanitation systems by Saudi airstrikes, has already killed more than 2,000 people. The Saudi government grounded all humanitarian aid flights into Yemen after a missile was fired into Saudi Arabia from Yemen on November 4th. The Saudis blame the Houthi rebels, charging that the missile was supplied by Iran, which they assert may be considered an act of war. The U.S. has aided the Saudi bombing campaign with intelligence, in-air refueling, and weapon sales. In a rare bipartisan challenge to U.S. involvement in conflicts abroad, the House of Representatives passed a resolution on November 13th, which states that U.S. military support for Saudi Arabia in its war against Yemen has not been authorized by Congress. Your reporter spoke with Shireen Al-Adimi, a Harvard graduate school student, originally from Yemen, who discusses the humanitarian crisis which the conflict has triggered, and U.S. complicity with Saudi Arabia in the ongoing war.
The Saudis have been bombing indiscriminately. They have not left anything unbombed. So houses, schools, hospitals, Doctors Without Borders, MSF, they had in 1 year, four of their hospitals were bombed. And this is after they were providing coordinates, exact coordinates to the Saudi-led coalition saying, hey, don't bomb us, we're a hospital. And that didn't seem to help either. Saudi in Yemen has been known for committing double tap strikes, which means that they bomb an area, and then when rescue operations are underway, they come and they bomb the rescuers one more time. And we've had double tap and triple tap attacks in Yemen consistently. You know, in October of last year, they bombed a funeral home, killing 140 or 150 people. And so they have crossed every boundary. Nobody has been left unscathed by their bombing campaign. And they're using, you know, the blockade as a form of control as well. They are starving people to death in Yemen. And that's another one of those violations that they continue to commit, you know, with impunity. Unfortunately, the United States has been helping them right from the beginning under the Obama administration and continuing through the Trump administration. The United States, of course, has huge weapons deals with Saudi Arabia, and so do a lot of other countries. But we go further. We provide mid-air support while the jets are flying and they're bombing civilians or targeting whatever they're targeting. The U.S. provides mid-air refueling for the Saudi jets, and they provide logistics and training and all sorts of things. And so it's really difficult to justify why we're in Yemen, and I think that's part of the reason, you know, nobody's really talking about the conflict in Yemen.
I've read that up to 7 million people in Yemen face starvation because of the air and sea blockade. And we also have a situation there where thousands of people are dying from cholera. primarily children.
The world's worst outbreak of cholera is happening in Yemen right now. Haiti, at the peak of their cholera outbreak, which took 5 years, they were at 700,000 cases. Yemen has already passed 900,000 cases in just a few months. The treatment for cholera is clean water, and people don't have clean water to drink. And so the most vulnerable are those who are very young, children and the elderly, people who have been compromised by hunger and, you know, their bodies have been weakened by starvation and whatnot. Over 2,000 have already died. The blockade means that people aren't getting food, or, you know, very little food and medicine is coming into the country. And, you know, prior to the war, Yemen used to import 90% of its food. And so there's nothing really growing in the country. We have a water crisis, and so people are starving. And whatever little food remains, people can't afford anymore because civil servants haven't been paid in a year. And those who are being paid, you know, prices have skyrocketed. The country is set to run out of fuel in 1 month and run out of vaccines in 1 month. So it's really, when the UN says this is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, it's not an exaggeration. Millions and millions of people are already at risk of starvation. People are already dying of starvation, and it's just going to get worse if the Saudis don't lift the blockade.
What can you tell us about any actions that have taken place within the U.S. Congress to address the U.S. involvement in this bloody war in Yemen, given the fact we provide intelligence, air refueling, and the sale of large amounts of weapons that are being used by the Saudis in this war?
Right. Congressman Ro Khanna from California introduced House Concurrent Resolution 81, and it says, directing the President pursuant to Section 5C of the War Powers Resolution to remove the United States Armed Forces from unauthorized hostilities in the Republic of Yemen. And under the War Powers Resolution, this would have been a privileged bill, which meant that they had to vote on it and debate it in the House and then vote on this U.S. involvement in Yemen. But unfortunately, it was stripped of its privileged status. And what we learned from Ro Khanna is that he ended up negotiating an alternate resolution, which is House Resolution 599. And House Resolution 599 is non-binding. It just basically says, you know, we need to have an urgent political solution in Yemen. We denounce the activities of all parties in Yemen. It repeats a lot of the Saudi rhetoric on Iranian involvement, and it was passed in the House overwhelmingly. But this isn't the resolution that Yemenis were hoping for. This isn't the resolution that people in Yemen were hoping for that would extricate the United States from involvement in Yemen, because without the United States' support, the Saudis cannot sustain this war. They rely very heavily on U.S. support in Yemen, intelligence, logistical training, all of those things, besides the weapons, of course. And so it's really disappointing that there is this one chance, there's this hope for the United States, finally after 2.5 years, to get out of Yemen, not be involved in these war crimes that the Saudis are committing, but nothing concrete so far.
That was Shireen Al-Adeimi, a Harvard graduate school student originally from Yemen. Learn more about the conflict in Yemen and the humanitarian crisis there by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. President Trump has nominated Alex Azar, a former top pharmaceutical executive, to be named Secretary of Health and Human Services. If confirmed by the U.S. Senate, Azar would replace Tom Price, who resigned as HHS Secretary in September after it was disclosed that his questionable trips on private jets had cost taxpayers more than $1 million. Azar served as president of the Eli Lilly Pharmaceutical Company's U.S. division for 5 years, and prior to that was HHS General Counsel in the George W. Bush administration. Azar has condemned the Affordable Care Act, supports converting Medicaid from an entitlement program to state block grants, and opposes Obamacare's expansion of Medicaid to working families meeting income guidelines. Healthcare advocacy groups and Senate Democrats are doubtful that Azar will pursue policies to rein in the runaway price of prescription drugs, although during his campaign, Trump favored negotiations to lower drug prices. The National Nurses United Union condemned Azar's nomination, saying it's like employing a lion to herd your sheep. While Azar led Lilly USA, the company's Humalog brand of insulin more than doubled in price. Your reporter spoke with Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive turned whistleblower, who's just launched a new investigative news platform called Tarbell. Here, Potter explains why he believes that Azar, if confirmed as HHS secretary, will be a disaster for millions of consumers who already are unable to afford critical prescription medicines.
Well, not only is he truly representing the pharmaceutical industry, I think he'll be representing the special interest broadly in healthcare. He was also serving as treasurer of this organization called the Healthcare Leadership Council, which sounds like a very useful organization and one that might have some benefit to consumers and patients. But what it is an organization that represents the interest of pharmaceutical companies and insurance companies and big hospitals and medical device manufacturers. When I was in my old corporate job, I used to work with that organization, and it often was the place that would send out press releases, and it's based in Washington, create campaigns to benefit the industry. So bottom line here, we have an individual who is very deeply involved in his career in supporting private enterprise in the healthcare business, trying, the whole reason for the existence of the Healthcare Leadership Council is to fend off any kinds of government regulation out of the fear that any kind of regulations would hinder profits. So he's very much a company man, and I just don't think that we'll see much in terms of any attention being paid to reducing the cost of medications.
What I've read about Alex Azar since his nomination by President Trump is that he is a firm opponent of any form of price controls on pharmaceutical drugs, which of course seems normal for a former CEO of one of the largest pharmaceutical companies. But Wendell, what do we know about his position on some of the proposals to constrain prices for people who really depend on these drugs to maintain their health?
What we know is that during his time at Lilly, the company increased the price of some of his medications significantly. We also know that he is on the record as saying that he thinks that rather than the government being involved to control costs, that should be done at the private level. He has suggested that insurers and pharmaceutical companies should work more closely together to do that. But my question, my response to that is, my gosh, they've had decades to do that. What does he think that is going to give them the incentive to do that now? How is he going to do that? Because the reality is that neither health insurers nor pharmaceutical companies want to make less money. And they had this game going of pointing the finger of blame away from themselves and toward the other, but they have a very symbiotic relationship. So it's just foolishness to think that the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry would ever do anything to bring costs down. In fact, they worked very cooperatively. They did work very cooperatively, as a matter of fact, when the Congress was considering the Medicare prescription drug benefit. And it was written by lobbyists for insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies. So in that sense, they did collaborate, and that with members of Congress. And as a part of that, Medicare was prohibited from negotiating for lower prices. So the insurers and the pharmaceutical companies got a very sweet deal out of that, but not so much the taxpayers.
Wendell, you understand the games that go on in Washington, and I'm wondering, as you look at the nomination process for Alex Azar to be the next Secretary of Health and Human Services, what are the prospects that you think he can be effectively challenged, at least by the Democrats within the Senate?
Well, I think they really do need to challenge him and find out what he actually proposes to do about high drug costs and what his strategy would be, or at least what he would do as a leader of that department, which, of course, includes the Medicare and Medicaid programs. What are his plans for those programs? And would he continue to resist efforts to give Medicare the ability to have lower cost? What's he going to do in many different areas that pertain to the Affordable Care Act? He's spoken very negatively of that law, which does certainly have its flaws, but has been a lifesaver for many people, has brought so many people into coverage. So there are a lot of questions that I think members of both parties should be asking, but Democrats in particular should be very concerned about what he likely would do with regards to both jurisdiction over pharmaceutical companies and the price of drugs, as well as the Affordable Care Act.
That was Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive and author, who's just launched a new investigative news platform, tarbell.org. Find more commentary on Alex Azar's nomination to be the next Health and Human Services Secretary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Just before the United Nations convened COP23 in Bonn, Germany, the 23rd Conference of Parties to discuss and reach agreement to take action to halt climate change, the American Public Health Association launched its annual conference in Atlanta on November 4th. The theme of the five-day gathering this year was climate change and health, which was attended by some 12,000 public health professionals and students, mostly from the U.S., but also from 40 other nations. The conference keynote speaker was Ariel Sakwe-Duranger, a member of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation of northern Alberta, Canada. She's a leader in the Indigenous Environmental Network Canadian Tar Sands campaign, which is working to stop construction of four different pipelines that would carry tar sands, the dirtiest, most energy-intensive oil on the planet, from Alberta to the U.S., other parts of Canada, and beyond. Duranger talked about the terrible health and climate impacts on her people due to fossil fuel contamination and the move away from traditional hunting and trapping to consumption of processed foods. Health consequences, she said, include lower life expectancies, increased levels of obesity, diabetes linked to diet, respiratory diseases caused by the drivers of climate change, and increased cancer rates. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the American Public Health Association conference, where she recorded and produced this excerpt of Duranger's talk.
The land is the very essence of who we are. It nurtures our bodies, our minds, our cultures, and our connection to our role on this planet Earth, Mother Earth. I want my children to know what it means to be Dene. I want this picture and these experiences of mine not to be relics of the past, but something to be celebrated by future generations. But that is all being threatened right now because of global climate change. Humanity is facing a global crisis, climate change. Indigenous people are not only threatened by the colonial ideologies and policies to eradicate our civil and human rights, but our very cultures and our identities are threatened by man-made climate change, precipitated by colonial ideologies rooted in things like capitalism. We're witnessing coastlines rising, floods, out-of-control forest fires, and species disappearing, changing weather patterns. And it's these impacts that are being disproportionately felt by communities least responsible for climate change and those that are most vulnerable in society, like communities like my own. But right now, my people's lands and territories is under threat from the largest industrial project on planet Earth, the Alberta oil sands. This is not your sweet conventional crude oil. It's thicker, like peanut butter, and at room temperature, when it's extracted from the ground, is almost as hard as a rock. It has a relatively higher concentration of nitrogen, sulfur, and heavy metals, and it's the pace and scale of this development that makes it out of control. 10% of the world's oil reserves exist in my people's traditional territory. 10%. Over 96% of Canada's total oil reserves are contained within the traditional territories of the Dene, the Cree, and the Métis people. Currently, over 900 square kilometers of land have been disturbed for tar sands mining. Over 4,000 square kilometers have been leased out to projects right now. Currently, the industry uses 170 billion liters, not million, billion liters of water, fresh water, every single year, and this is only expected to increase. This fresh water ends up in toxic tailings ponds that now cover 260 square kilometers of land, held in place with some of the world's largest earthen dams. And every day, these toxic tailings leach into our river systems, contaminating our water systems, contaminating our foods. However, mining is not even the only accessible method. The other 80%, because 20% is mining, is in situ. And in situ is similar to fracking, in so much that you steam and you put pressure into the ground. And in this case, we're superheating fresh water and diluents or solvents at high pressure, injecting them into the ground to melt the bitumen so that underlying pipelines can suck it back up and ship it off to refineries. In the end, in situ operations require more energy and generate 2.5 times as much greenhouse gas per barrel than mining operations. These projects now represent 31% more emissions than the average conventional crude oil. And they're the fastest single growing emitter of greenhouse gas emissions in Canada. They create more emissions than all the cars on the road combined in the country, Canada, not the United States. And they stand as a barrier for us meeting our climate commitments. More than ever, we need to move towards decolonizing not just the environment, but decolonizing our solutions. Indigenous peoples are exercising our sovereign rights to implement our own environmental and health infrastructures to regulate and enforce our own laws within our lands and territories as defined by the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, Articles 3 and 10. We are our own experts. We are doctors, biologists, scientists, educators, and we have the fundamental right to exist and build our own systems in partnership with our settler partners.
That was Arielle Sekwe Deranger of the Canadian Indigenous Tar Sands Campaign. Learn more about the campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WUML in Lowell, Massachusetts, WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, KYRS in Spokane, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.